This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They might not want to get rid of it entirely. They might want to do reforms like have a talking filibuster or put the onus back on the minority to have everyone who's in the minority who wants to stop debate show up.
The days of bipartisanship in Washington are long gone, but there are many on the Hill still clinging for dear life to this antiquated notion, which really hasn't existed since the 1980s. This week on Sea Change Radio, we're joined by political consultant Aaron Huertas in the first half of a two-part conversation to look at the variety of political options facing a Democratic Party, which is currently holding a razor-thin majority in the Senate. We discuss the current state of the filibuster, dive into the many ways to craft policy with and without it, and look at the role that unions and grassroots organizers will play in moving us away from this obsession over bipartisanship. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Aaron Huertas. Aaron is a political consultant, and he is currently working as a communications director for Catalyst. Aaron, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be in touch.
Yes, for our listeners, we've had Aaron on several times over the years, and I find him to be one of the more astute political observers. And last time we spoke, Aaron, I believe Donald Trump was still president, though, so things have changed quite a bit.
Yeah, we made it. You know, we're on the other side of that now. I live in downtown DC, so I can see the very tippy top of the Capitol right now from my home office. And being here on January 6th was pretty scary. We had a lot of Trump supporters in my neighborhood staying at hotels. That was the first time I saw local activists in DC totally stand down and say, this is really dangerous. We don't want our people out there on the streets. Let them fight with the cops and the feds. So that was a really scary moment for all of us. But we made it through it, and Donald Trump isn't president, and he's off Twitter, and he just had to cancel his blog. So that's good for us, but it's still a very scary time for democracy.
Yes, and that's why I wanted to talk, because you posted something on your own blog, aaronhuertas.com. The post is from May 28th, and it's entitled, U.S. Politics is Broken, But What If Politicians Don't Fix It? We've been talking a lot over the last few months about the filibuster, and people who had never heard of Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, the senators from Arizona and West Virginia, respectively, are thinking about them much more than they had thought they might 6 months ago. Do we face a time of choosing between the filibuster or democracy, in your opinion, Aaron?
I think that we do, because we're in democratic decline, and I don't think it's totally binary right now. This decline could take place over many election cycles and over a long period of time. It could happen very rapidly. I think that we were lucky on January 6th that none of the elected officials were killed or harmed, right? They were in physical danger. What happened was very dangerous. Ultimately, it was a mob, right? And there were people who were deeply organized in that mob, but a lot of folks were there for the show, right? The QAnon shaman was not armed, but he still got into the Senate well. So the people, the militia types, the people who are facing federal charges now, they were mixed in with sort of the menagerie of Trump supporters that had come out there that Trump incited that day. So that's really dangerous. The other big danger signs we're seeing now are these fake audits that Republican state legislators are calling for. We see Republicans who reject the election results running for election official positions like secretaries of state. And for many years, the secretaries of state, even in places where they would run with a partisan label, they took the nonpartisan nature of their jobs very seriously. And last election cycle, I interviewed a lot of election administrators from across the country. And at that local level, at that county level, You know, it's really rare that you run into people who are, Twitter, Facebook level conspiracy theorist types. And I think, now what we're seeing is a lot of those election administrators, they're facing a ton of political pressure from their state legislatures, and, in some cases from their governors. And we're also seeing things like in Arizona, threats to strip the Democratic Secretary of State there of her powers. So stuff like that, it's not voter suppression, it's election subversion. It's attempts to ignore, obviate the results of an election. And there might not be direct policy solutions to that sort of thing. The solutions to that might be, with us broadly, with civil society, with the kinds of counter mobilizations that we saw in the 2020 election around the country. So there's a lot of policies we could pass that could fight voter suppression, that could make doing this sort of stuff harder, that could make it easier to organize, right, across unions and across the progressive movement. But ultimately, a lot of the solutions to these problems remain political. So this might not be the kind of problem we can fix with a law. This is a very deep problem in our political culture.
Yes, I mean, just thinking on these local elections that are being contested by the people who don't win them, usually these Republicans who have now kind of taken a page out of Donald Trump's book in not accepting the results irrespective of the reality of the results. And when we have a party where the orthodoxy is kind of tested, whether or not you're going to accept the Biden-Trump results, you could see how that could easily trickle down to the Secretary of State race in Arizona.
Yeah. And I think it's the combination of, voter suppression, making it harder to vote, creating multiple steps where something might go wrong with the ballot, and then election subversion. So now you've created a different category of ballots that you say are going to count or not count after the fact. So what we saw in 2020, that, there was an attempt there from the Republicans and from the Trump campaign to say these late arriving mail ballots that we think are heavily Democratic because we've politicized how people think about different vote methods, we want to go and cancel these late arriving mail ballots. Now, it turns out Biden and Harris assembled a pretty big coalition and won the swing states by enough where those late arriving mail ballots weren't decisive anyway. So, we dodged that circumstance and the courts were able to shoot down these silly lawsuits. And, of course, the Trump campaign wasn't doing this stuff in a competent way. They were doing it in a very farcical way. And there's aspects of it that are funny that we can make fun of, but it's still deadly serious. They're trying to subvert a presidential election at a state level in a coordinated way. So, there's an alternative timeline where that election was even tighter and it would come down to something like that in one of those states. And I think what we're seeing now is an attempt by a lot of Republican state legislatures to say, we want to give ourselves more flexibility when it comes to subverting election results we don't like after the fact. That's not new in American politics, right? This is part of what happened with Reconstruction and attempts to undermine elections in the South after the Civil War. But this is the modern version of it, right? This is a retrenchment and this is resistance to democracy.
It's definitely not the type of democracy that we aspire to. And it's definitely not the democracy that we've been used to when the minority party is trying to cheat its way into the majority. That's essentially what we have right now, is that they're using any means necessary, state, local, and federal levels, and through the courts to try to get the 40% who they represent to represent more than 50%. That's the basic calculus, right? It's definitely anti-democratic efforts that they're using, but will it shake the bedrock of our system is the question, I guess.
Yeah, political scientists would say it's anti-majoritarian, right? So we don't have a purely democratic system. We have a democratic republic. We have a republic with regular elections, and we live by the results of those elections. And that's what's being challenged now. And when we look at things like, debates about the filibuster, that the filibuster is one of the most anti-majoritarian things in our system. And if you look at the Constitution, there's no filibuster in there. This is a custom in the Senate. It goes back to the pre-Civil War era and pro-slavery senators trying to find ways to block the anti-slavery majority from going after slavery. So that's still with us. And the filibuster has been chipped away at over time. And, now it's very clear that if you want to do something on voting rights legislation, if you want to do something on the democratic right to organize in your workplace through something like the PRO Act, even if you want to do basic stuff like pass a budget or do some COVID relief, you got to work around the filibuster one way or the other. And on budgetary issues, we can go through a reconciliation process through the Senate parliamentarian. And again, none of this is in the Constitution. This is all the Senate's own rules. And on these budgetary matters, we can do a 50-50 vote on partisan lines, and Vice President Harris can break the tie. But then on these non-budgetary matters, on things like the PRO Act, voting rights, DC statehood, if we ever get there, you need to deal with the filibuster. And we saw that in really, I'm not sure if there's going to be any more dramatic way to demonstrate this, but even the creation of a commission to study what happened on 1-6 and bring some sense of transparency and justice and maybe even reconciliation to that attack on our democracy, that vote failed, even though 54 senators voted for it, including 6 Republicans. So you had, especially for our era, a pretty bipartisan majority vote, representing senators who represent a majority of people in the country, saying they wanted to form this commission, and it failed, right? It's to see headlines that say, the 54 to 36 vote happened in the Senate and the side with 36 won. Right, it offends our sensibilities if we love democracy. And what's really happening is that the majority that keeps showing up for elections and electing Democrats, that majority is not able to rule. And the filibuster is a big reason for that. But of course, there's also gerrymandering. There's also the nature of the Senate itself and how each party's coalitions have changed. If you've got 2 senators from California, they represent a heck of a lot more people than the 2 senators from Vermont or the 2 senators from Alabama. So there's always going to be that population disparity there in how the Senate's constituted. But something like the filibuster just makes it so much worse.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to political consultant Aaron Huertas. So, Aaron, let's dive a little deeper into the struggle over the filibuster. First, let's assume that the filibuster is not going away, and then we'll dive into those logistics a little later. And instead of getting into the characters behind it and their motivations, let's just assume that we're in the status quo right now, and that it's the filibuster's not going away. And that's pretty much the thesis of your post. So what can progressives do to try to break the status quo in terms of policies when they're not going to be able to hypothetically break the status quo of the system itself?
Yeah, this is a possibility I really want people who work in progressive politics to think about, because I remember I stayed up late on the night of January 5th to see the results come in from Georgia. And, things were looking good with the early vote, but I don't think anybody was sitting here saying, oh, we're definitely going to win Georgia. We feel great about this. And that was a genuinely surprising result. And having the ability to govern again and have a trifecta in D.C., that was huge. So now there's this window for governing, and it's a lot more limited than the window Obama came in with in 2008, right? It's a smaller Senate majority. It's very slim. So I take Senator Manchin at his word when he says he doesn't want to mess with the filibuster and he doesn't want to do DC voting rights. He's for the PRO Act and some of these other priorities. But I think when you step back and you look at the Senate structurally, there's a lot of senators who are open now to the idea of reforming the filibuster, and they might not want to get rid of it entirely. They might want to do reforms like have a talking filibuster or put the onus back on the minority to have everyone who's in the minority who wants to stop debate show up.
Yeah, explain how that works, because that seems to be the lowest hanging fruit for those who want filibuster reform.
Yeah, this is something Senator Merkley from Oregon has talked about many times. And his idea is that you would have to do the, you know, Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith goes to Washington style filibuster again. And that is traditionally, like, when you learn about the filibuster in, you know, high school civics class, if you were lucky enough to take a high school civics class, that's what you picture. It's the lone senator either bravely standing up for something great and convincing their colleagues to go along with them, or, you know, in the history of the actual use of the filibuster, you know, standing up for states' rights to do things that are racist, right, and preventing the majority from ending racist practices. So in practice, though, the filibuster in the modern era just works as a threat, right? The minority leader and, you know, a handful of senators can say, well, you know, we're going to filibuster that, so, you know, don't go there. And you can just say that you're going to filibuster something. You don't actually have to go through it. And then, you know, if the majority leader brings something to the floor that people have to vote on, they have to vote to end debate and break the filibuster. So there's not actually a filibuster happening. There's not actually a senator standing in the well of the Senate with the TV cameras on and everyone saying, wow, look, you know, look at this guy holding up the people's business in the Senate. So that lack of public scrutiny probably makes it easier to filibuster, right? In a world where we change that, there would be a higher price to pay politically for filibustering something, especially filibustering something popular, right? The senators who refused to vote for the 1-6 commission, they didn't have to stand up for, you know, 17 hours explaining why a commission was a bad idea or reading from the phone book or what have you.
Beyond the filibuster, what are some of the best ways for the Biden administration to move forward? How can it enact policies that will, let's say, save voting rights in states where they're very much under fire?
They would have to decide, and this is at the federal level, because the Senate is so closely contested, Vice President Harris has some more leverage there as the deciding vote on tie-breaking votes, but the Vice President's also President of the Senate. So she actually has a lot of flexibility in these parliamentarian rulings that are coming down about so-called reconciliation bills. So traditionally, the parliamentarian advises the Senate on, you know, what's admissible to do per the Senate's rules. And people can ask the parliamentarian different questions. The parliamentarian can answer them. It's, you know, it's a very nonpartisan position, although occasionally parliamentarians have come under political pressure, often from Republicans on budgetary matters, and Republicans have gotten their way.
Yes, we just learned who the parliamentarian was when the $15 minimum wage that they wanted to put in the initial budget, correct?
Right. Yeah. So the parliamentarian decides whether or not something has budgetary impact. And you can get real loosey-goosey with that, right? So something like the minimum wage, you could say, well, of course this has budgetary impact. It affects people's wages and the taxes they pay. Like, you know, pretty quickly down the line, you got something that's related to the federal budget. And, you know, if you put on your lawyer hat for a second and really want to plead your case, you could say to the parliamentarian, well, you know, voting rights have a budgetary impact too, because the federal government spends money to support election administration in the states. So this would change how the federal government looks at some of those state allocations, right? So, you know, the parliamentarian's rulings, they can be arbitrary. You can imagine a scenario where the vice president says, well, I don't accept the parliamentarian's ruling on this, so we're going to go ahead and do it the way we want to do it. Or like we saw with the minimum wage, okay, well, let's have a vote on whether or not this should go in there, as opposed to it just being included, you know, on its own in this reconciliation package. And in that case, you know, some of the senators, they either were not in favor of a $15 minimum wage, or they said, you know, I don't want to do it this way. I want to have a more robust debate about the minimum wage, and I actually want to have that. Like, I don't want to just put it into this package. But realistically, you know, how's this stuff going to get through if we're in a system where even for something like the 1-6 commission, just something that should be in normal times a bipartisan slam dunk, is only going to get 6 Republican votes, right? How do you pass anything? And that's kind of the time of choosing now. So I think they have some flexibility there. that they're not using right now that they could use in the future that maybe they have some leverage over. And of course, Senator Sanders is you know, the progressive champion in the Democratic coalition. He's the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, so he has a lot of say in those matters too.
So Aaron, you also write about the role that grassroots activists and union leaders will have and have had in preventing Democratic backsliding during this very fragile period. Why don't you expand on how grassroots activists and unions can make a significant impact moving forward?
Yeah, I was really proud of what all the progressive groups and local activists and unions did in 2020 when we faced this very immediate threat to the integrity of the election. And in the pre-election period, this included things that the Postal Carriers Union did to ensure the integrity of the mail and to make sure that we got our mail ballots and that we could return our mail ballots on time. And they were doing that in direct opposition to Trump's appointee as Postmaster General. So that was really impressive. Then at the local level, local activists in D.C., we did a wake-up call for DeJoy outside his condo in D.C., right? And we got a lot of media attention for that. We showed massive public support for, you know, our ability to do mail ballots in the middle of a pandemic. And we were able to do, you know, our activism in a socially distanced, pandemic-friendly way. We're all masked up. We kept our distance from each other. We were outside, right? So that sort of flexibility across the progressive movement was really important for making sure we could have the election and that people did have access to the ballot, including mail ballots. Then in the post-election period, I was blown away by how strategic and coordinated and thoughtful and tactical everyone in the movement was, right? And this was from the level of like people doing live messaging research every day, every week, and informing the entire progressive movement about how people were thinking about the election. It involved a lot of strategic foresight, I think, from the Biden campaign and the now Biden administration too, and not feeding into Trump's election lies and not making the election about whether or not Trump was going to subvert the election, because we had a big worry there, and that was backed up in messaging research that if you talk too much about something like a coup or a stolen election before people actually voted, it demobilized people. It made them want to vote less, right? And that makes intuitive sense, because if you're telling somebody your vote might not count, well, why are they going to go fill out the application? Why are they going to go to the early voting site? So I think that was very smart too. Then when the Republicans actually started to try to subvert the election, we saw a lot of very smart local activism. In Michigan, when they had an election board certify their election results, and there were some threats from Republicans there to mess with that process, you had an overwhelming turnout, in virtual meetings and on the streets to say, this is unacceptable. You need to certify our votes now. And they got these local board, the Republicans on that local board, to switch their votes, right? And that was happening all across the country, directly or indirectly. I did an action at National Airport here in D.C. where we intercepted a couple Michigan state legislators who Trump had invited to the White House to talk to them about subverting their election. And so they had local activists in Michigan. We call it bird dogging, but bird dogging them, asking them tough questions, taking videos of those interactions at the airport when they left. And then they had a bunch of local activists here in D.C. Greet them when they came here and landed in D.C. So we got to ask them a ton of tough questions. And ultimately, you know, they didn't take the bait. They said, we just had a nice conversation about priorities for economic recovery in Michigan or whatever. And they didn't go into full subversion mode. They're still doing bad stuff, but in that moment, I think that public pressure and that activism made a huge difference in making it just that much harder for these Republican legislators to get away with election subversion.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to political consultant Aaron Huertas. So the motivations of the Feinsteins and the Sinemas of the Senate are quite different. So connecting these dots, how can the grassroots activists and unions overwhelm the motivations of these few individuals who are kind of clogging progress?
Well, I think Senator Ed Markey's experience on this is really illustrative. And I'm a huge Ed Markey fan because I've worked in climate policy for so long. And Senator Markey has always been a climate champ. And a few years ago, this was when they were unveiling some Green New Deal legislation, not in this Congress, but in the last Congress, Senator Markey was asked, well, how are you going to get a Green New Deal through or anything like it through the Senate? And he said, well, we're going to convince enough Republicans to get on board and we're going to do this thing. And of course, people who work in the climate movement will say, well, you know, we tried that in 2009. It didn't work out well. We didn't get national climate legislation. Things are even worse now. Yeah, how's that going to happen? And Senator Markey wound up getting a primary challenge from Representative Joe Kennedy. And Joe Kennedy was trying to run to Markey's left on the filibuster and saying, we need to nuke the filibuster to get this good stuff done. And, you know, Markey said he was open to it. Republicans would have to show him a lot of intransigence first. And I think Markey's actually come around on it, having had that debate in a primary, having had the climate movement really, you know, stand arm in arm with him to win that primary. I think he's the first Massachusetts politician to defeat a Kennedy in a statewide race. So, you know, he inspired a lot of people in the climate movement, a lot of young voters. And, you know, now when you talk to him about the filibuster, And when you see how he answers questions from journalists, he's much more of the mind that Republicans have shown their intransigence, and it's time to do something about the filibuster. Otherwise, we're not going to get any of this stuff done, including climate legislation. So when I think about other senators, you know, do they have room to move? Do they have room to grow on this? I think they do, but I am really skeptical that it's going to happen this Congress, especially after that last vote. I really do hope that something changes, but when we look at the real long term here and the Democratic Party's ability to have a majority in the Senate and in the House and its ability to elect people who are going to put some of the reforms in place that make the system more democratic, I think it's up to these progressive groups to really elevate democracy and voting rights when they're thinking about their candidate endorsements, when they're thinking about contested primaries and who they want to back. The other big area of growth I'd like to see is more of an emphasis on workplace organizing and democracy and where that fits in. Because I do think the average activist donor who might be active with, say, a swing left or an Indivisible, they might be, you know, a college educated person who maybe has limited experience with unions. And I think that the Democratic coalition is those folks and the working class who are, you know, in unions and want economic opportunity and want racial justice, and many of whom are quite active through their union. So, you know, the combination of those two things, that's really the core of the Democratic coalition, especially when it comes to the activist voices that are pushing for policy. So more unity between those things, I think, is good. And the unity that we did have in 2020 in that post-election period, I think, was really critical for, you know, ensuring that all the votes were counted and making sure that the win that Biden and Harris were able to assemble resulted in a real win where they got sworn in.
Aaron Huertas, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Be sure to tune in next week for the second half of my discussion with political consultant Aaron Huertas.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Joe Henry and the Meters.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.